You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
We cannot allow this ideology the safe space it needs to breed. Yet that is precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide.
UK Prime Minister for the moment, Theresa May attempts to return to business as usual, discussing anti-terror measures with a rather more comfortably ensconced President of France. My guests Samira Shackle and Roger Boyes will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
It's a confidence game, like with a lion. The lion tamers have to act totally confident, beat that lion, keep it under submission, dominate it. Because if you ever want to show fear one time when your head's in its mouth, snap like a bear trap on your head.
NBC's decision to interview InfoWars agitator Alex Jones, holding a legitimate public figure to account or giving a platform to a maniac. Plus, the EU takes legal action against three of its members over refugee and migrant quotas, and Donald Trump's extremely weird first cabinet meeting. That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, contributor to Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, The New Statesman and Monocle, among others, and Roger Boyes, diplomatic editor of The Times. Welcome both. And we will start here in the United Kingdom, where 5 days after its most recent general election, the political situation continues to resemble a cross between the closing scenes of Reservoir Dogs and Blazing Saddles. There are countries in which it would be unwise in such febrile circumstances for the head of government to travel abroad, lest the locks be changed in their absence. It is some tribute to the solidity of Britain's institutions that Prime Minister Theresa May feels able to visit Paris to meet France's rather more solidly incumbent president, Emmanuel Macron. Samira, first of all, the reason for this meeting is to discuss anti-terror measures. What has not been done already that still could be?
I think they want to introduce sort of concrete penalties on big online companies like Facebook, YouTube, etc., etc., to sort of put the onus on them to censor extremist content. So I think the main thing is fines, but basically putting a sort of legal liability onto those companies to have to remove that content, because I don't think they sort of have much penalty at the moment on that. It's already obviously quite... wide-ranging anti-terror powers and various things, but in May, sort of after the recent spate of terror attacks in the UK, she really put this question of online radicalisation and sort of censoring the internet, which is a big sort of preoccupation of hers anyway, not even when you're not looking at anti-terror stuff, but she really put that at the centre of the Tory manifesto, talking about this thing of limiting, sort of putting the onus on companies to limit it, and also, which isn't coming up with Macron, I think, but she's also got a big obsession about stopping end-to-end encryption.
Roger, is this an overdue measure, the holding internet providers accountable for what they disseminate? Do we need to start thinking of platforms like Facebook and Twitter not merely as morally neutral means of communication, but more like newspapers?
Yes, I mean, yes, you're right. They're publishers, basically, and they should be held to account just as my newspaper is or just as Monocle is. They have to conform to basic rules, but of course what they're doing is using encryption as part of their business model. So the argument they're having is they're worrying that their profits are going down. We're worried that lives are being lost. So in this contest, which is of course framed like that by the politicians, the politicians win hands down, but it's not so simple. What's been agreed today with between Macron and May is rather modest compared to some of the things that we want. We want a proper backdoor, basically, into suspicious traffic. I don't know. I think actually this was something that was worked up not because of London Bridge, but was worked up a little bit earlier after the Manchester thing because of the Libyan connection. The French have a lot of worries about Libya. And so do we now. So do we. So so there was a lot of sort of cross traffic there about it, and then suddenly it was decided that the whole issue of security, which was at one stage of the Brexit kind of pre-debate, that's about 3 months ago, was supposed to be a fundamental pillar of our British negotiating position in on Brexit, has been sort of peeled off, and now we're talking as a matter of goodwill bilaterally with France about the two, you know, between two big military powers of the European Union, about how we should jointly look at intelligence questions and counterterrorism questions. And so I think that's the symbolism of the moment today. It's sort of saying we're not going to be toxified by Brexit, and we're not going to drive you hard and say, you know, we will remove the British security component from the European Union unless you play ball. It's basically saying the opposite.
On the subject of symbolism, Samira, one of the things that they will be doing is going to the Stade de France tonight to attend the France versus England football game. The Stade de France was, of course, itself the target of a terror attack in December 2015. How important is a symbolic gesture of that sort?
I don't know. I mean, I think I don't know if it, I mean, I don't think it makes sort of concrete change. I think there's something that can be morale boosting for people affected. For instance, with the Manchester concert that was held a couple of weeks ago, you know, I don't think that makes a sort of concrete difference to people who want to carry out acts of terror. But I do think for people who are affected, for people who might be feeling afraid, those kinds of gestures have significance in that way, I think.
Roger, we should also look at the optics of this from the point of view of British domestic politics. Does this work well for Theresa May? As in, does it demonstrate a Prime Minister going about her business as usual? Or does she sort of suffer in the comparison with Emmanuel Macron? Are we witnessing a lame duck going to visit the recently elected President of France, who recently also scored a thumping result in a parliamentary election?
Yes, I mean, of course, that's the optics, isn't it? I mean, it's almost as if we're measuring our own decline against what's happening in France. You know, he's the kind of master of optimism, and we're in some kind of incredible end of times identity crisis. We're even having a row about who the fifth largest economy in the world is now, because France has decided that probably it is now. And we haven't even got the pluck to argue that. So we're having a complete kind of erectile dysfunction, and France is going, you know, way ahead.
Yeah, get careful with that comparison. We should look elsewhere in Europe now, specifically at Poland, the Czech Republic and Hungary, who now find themselves on the receiving end of legal action from the European Commission over their extreme reluctance to pull their weight vis-a-vis recent migrant and refugee inflows. Poland and Hungary refused to take any of the people that the EU was seeking to relocate from Greece and Italy, while the Czechs set the limit of their national generosity at 12, not 12,000 or 1,200, 12. The mechanism, now triggered, is known as an infringement procedure, under which everybody will yell at each other for years, after which fines may be issued, which might just about exceed the lawyers' bills. Samira, how important is this as a showdown between the European Commission and these three recalcitrant member states of the EU?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's the context should be clear that basically, everyone was quite reluctant about taking refugees.
Everybody was very reluctant.
Everybody was very reluctant.
Apart from Germany and Sweden.
Exactly. And that's basically why they decided.
They're changing their minds.
Yes. Initially enthusiastic, subsequently less so.
But if you look at, you know, it's it's small numbers across Europe. Everyone's very reluctant about it. So I think basically the EU has taken the decision, rightly or wrongly, that it's kind of meaningless imposing these kinds of quotas if people can just give two fingers up to it. So that's why they're pursuing it. I don't know if it's going to change attitudes. And of course, it's also the backdrop that there is discomfort in the European Union about certain sort of hyper-nationalistic governments and tendencies in particularly Hungary and Poland. So I think there's also that as the background to it. But, you know, I can think, given the fact that the refugee crisis isn't going away and that this is a very flagrant disregarding of that quite modest quota requirement, I can see why the European Commission is pursuing it. As you alluded to, it's likely to be a not particularly efficient process.
Roger, the three countries concerned cited security concerns as the basis for their reluctance. On a sliding scale between actual security concerns and populist pandering to domestic electorates, where do you think the marker is?
Well, I'm not very good with numbers, so I can't. But basically, obviously, it's fake, yeah? What they've done is taken two or three examples from the last 10 terror attacks in Western Europe, in Western European places that have taken refugees, and I think there's perhaps one or two who've claimed asylum. And they've taken the sexual assault that happened in Cologne, for example, New Year's Eve, the year before last in Cologne. And they've taken these examples and said, that's justification enough for us to resist, first of all, a compulsory quota, and second, to declare that we have to act in a national frame to honour our commitment to you know, protect our citizens. And of course, it's a statement about the future integration of Europe. It's saying they're part of the Visegrad 4, the Central European Axis, we do not actually want to be part of a Franco-German-driven rush towards integration. So we have the threat of populism receding in general. Even Italy is, even Beppe Grillo is having problems in Italy now. But we have a lot of people worried about, for the first time, British politics becoming unstable. So the answer that France and Germany draw out of this is there should be tighter integration. But over the other end of the continent, Central Europeans see the only major threat to their everyday life being the Russian invasion of the Baltics, perhaps, or something worse happening in Ukraine. They want a stronger NATO, and they do not want a centrally controlled, Brussels-steered push towards tighter European integration. So that's how it's all come about. That's how it's all things. But I must say, I spent many years in Poland as a correspondent, and I'm very disappointed in their churlishness on this. These countries, Hungary too, Slovakia too, are all Catholic countries, and they have strong churches that kept them independent thinking during the age of communism. And these churches aren't giving a squeak, you know. So I think it's not just states are failing, but that civil societies are failing in these countries.
Samira, the point you raised strikes me as the crucial one, which is that the refugees are not going to stop coming. We may not see that many more summers like the last couple, but they will, it seems reasonable to imagine, continue to arrive in large numbers, running comfortably into the tens of thousands. Assuming that is the case, and assuming these three countries, if others follow their lead, if European countries start just saying, well, we're not interested, we don't want them, we're not taking them, and you can't make us, where do these people end up going?
Well, I mean, just as we've seen, they end up sort of wasting their lives away, stuck in horrific conditions in places like Greece or Italy or wherever they've landed up, in sort of semi-formal or camps which might become formalised or not. They remain not part of a formal economy. You have entire generations of children completely lost because they don't have access to proper education. And it's a disaster. It's not just a humanitarian disaster. You know, I'm quite uncomfortable actually with the framing of the refugee crisis first and foremost as a security issue. But if you are framing it as a security issue, that is an issue when you have people for, you know, years and years and years stuck with no hope for the future. That's where you have a potential security issue. You don't have a security issue if you create schemes by which people can be resettled, can integrate into the economy and can live with dignity, because that's actually what the vast, vast, vast majority want. And that's why they come to Europe, to live with dignity and to live safely. And I think if you are framing it as a security problem, then you have absolutely no credibility if you don't take that into consideration.
Roger, why won't politicians in those three countries in particular actually make that point, which is fairly self-evident, that, I mean, nobody regards it as an ideal situation, but it is a problem that has to be addressed, and pretending it isn't there or refusing to deal with it is not going to solve it?
Yes, I mean, they're basically populist governments. So the whole point of framing refugees as a security threat is to encourage a basic groundswell of nationalist anger, and that's what's happening, and the people are voting for these parties like there's no tomorrow, and they're not looking at the details of it. They're not looking at the as Samira says, the actual danger of people being confined in mass camps, but honestly, Germany it's taken lots of people, but it's also not enamored of this situation. You know, it thinks it's being blackmailed by Turkey because Turkey has taken 2.5 million people and put them in the camps, and threatening to release, you know, threatens occasionally to let them cross into Europe. You know, it's a very complicated situation, and in the case of Poland and Hungary, we're dealing with very simple-minded governments.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Samira Shackle and Roger Boyce. Coming up next, should grown-up news outlets provide InfoWars nutbag Alex Jones with yet more of his preferred currency? Attention.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Roger Boyce. Now, in a sane world, there would be no compelling reason to pay much heed to Alex Jones, an online fulminator much beloved of unemployable tinfoil-hatted denizens of parental basements. We do not, however, presently live in a sane world. We have instead been condemned, for the moment at least, to dwell in one in which Jones' conspirazoid ravings have been endorsed by the President of the United States, no less. This weekend, American network NBC is due to air an interview with Jones by their new anchor, Megyn Kelly. But should they? Samira, first of all, Alex Jones, say whatever else you will about him, is a monstrously successful broadcaster. He has an audience of millions. He is part of the national conversation. Should he be ignored?
I think that it's a question about how you approach someone, isn't it? So you could, I mean, first of all, he has a big platform, as you said. He's not being ignored. Certainly, he's got reaching lots and lots and lots of viewers. I think the question is about the type of attention you give someone. I think, it's about the debate that's happening here is not, you know, should we censor him or whatever, because he's obviously getting lots of attention. It's about in what way do you deliver that attention and do you risk legitimising certain views? Because some of his views are just palpably not legitimate positions to hold. I think the one that's caused particular controversy here is the claim that the Sandy Hook massacre in an elementary school was a conspiracy, was a fake, basically, involving child actors, that was sort of created to bring in gun control laws. And so that's clearly not a legitimate view for debate, I don't think. And but so I can see why people are cross about it.
This is the difficulty, though, isn't it, Roger? Because every grown-up news outlet has to confront this at some point. If there is somebody unpleasant and cranky who is nonetheless part of a story, part of the conversation, do you deal with them and how do you deal with them? But is there a problem specifically with someone like Alex Jones, one might also argue with Donald Trump, that if a person just keeps insisting on saying obviously ridiculous things that you can bring no logical correction to bear upon, for example, that President Barack Obama was born in Kenya, is there even any point in attempting to have the conversation with them?
Well, I don't see what the alternative is. In a way, you can't just lock them up in a cell because then you end up, you know, in gulag territory. But I mean, the problem
you
is...
You don't have to censor them. It's just sort of saying we're not going to...
Well, I mean, the problem is when it soaks into policy, yeah? And that's what's happening. And that's why we're paying attention to this idiot. I mean, the three or four themes that have motivated him in his career have become part of the playbook of Donald Trump. And so there is a curiosity about where these ideas come from. So Trump, you know, with his ridiculous obsession with Obama's birthplace, the continuum is too short between someone like this shock jock and the president of the United States, and here's the problem. Yeah, so we have to. I mean, we've got shock jocks in Britain. We've got this Katie Hopkins or something, yeah, who suggested something, you know, really grotesque.
She's one of those people who manages... I don't know where you write off for one of these jobs where you just say stupid, mad stuff and people give you money.
I'd like one of those jobs.
I know. Yeah. You never see them advertised.
Yeah. No. But, you know, ultimately she's fired, yeah, Katie Hopkins. And so there is a corporate responsibility, really, to say, look, you're telling lies. It's okay. Sometimes it's amusing to tell lies. Sometimes it has to be flagged up as lies. But actually, I'm sorry, you know, you got to go.
I mean, Samira, is this okay as long as Megyn Kelly gives him a proper going over? Or is, again, do we run into that thing that whatever she says to him, if she does give him a proper wailing, he will then just say it was badly edited, quoted out of context, that it's all part of a conspiracy, etc., etc. It's that old adage about how you shouldn't mud wrestle with a pig, you both get filthy, the pig doesn't care, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously that is what he'll do, whatever she does. And I think you can make the argument both ways. I think certainly it's completely unacceptable if she doesn't give him a tough time of it. But I think the question is quite a tricky question. And I think often we confuse freedom of speech with right to have a particular platform, which is not the same. So you're not censoring someone if you don't give them a sort of easy ride on a mainstream news channel. I've just been thinking about this quite a lot recently, actually, after the... the London Bridge attack, and it emerged that the attacker had links with Al Mahajirun, which is run by Anjem Chowdhury. Now, Anjem Chowdhury, for instance, I think is quite a good example, because that's someone who has plainly extremist views and yet who was basically a rent-a-quote for...
Indeed, he was.
You know, for every national newspaper, magazine, TV channel, radio, whatever... and a lot of the time his views were being challenged, but he was being called up because he could be relied on to say something incendiary and ridiculous and sort of seems a bit cartoonish and silly. And then actually, you know, that's quite a tactic for attracting people to your ideas and bringing people around to your ways of thinking. The right person hears it and it doesn't sound ridiculous and mad. And so I think thinking about that actually elevating certain views can have a knock-on effect which isn't intended by the producer or whoever who's calling that person on.
Okay, just a final thought, quick thought on this from each of you. I'll ask you first, Roger, and then you, Samira. If you were the person in charge at NBC, the news director, do you put Alex Jones on the air or not?
No, I don't think you do. I think they've abdicated from the principle of filtering who's in your studio, and that's a fault.
Samira?
Yeah, I agree. with that.
Okay, well, finally tonight, on that conciliatory note, after 144 days in office, just 1,317 more to go, US President Donald Trump continues to find ways to do the things that not even his least forgiving critics imagined that even he would stoop to. The latest such is an excruciating meeting with his cabinet at which members thereof were invited to tell the gathering, and possibly more importantly, the watching cameras, what a marvelous job Trump was doing.
Thank you, Mr. President. It was a great honor traveling with you around the country for the last year, and an even greater honor to be here serving in your cabinet.
On behalf of the entire senior staff around you, Mr. President, we thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people, and we're continuing to work very hard every day to accomplish those goals.
Elaine Chao, Steve Mnuchin, and Rince Priebus there. I want all episodes of Midori House to start like that now. I want a solid 2 minutes of the guests telling me how fantastic I am.
Before. Well, not just that, a blessing, Andrew.
A blessing. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Sort of, he's got divine powers.
Praise to God for allowing you to be here in the room with me. Samira, how close are we here to those famous swimming races Idi Amin used to hold, where you sort of watched his hapless aides try to avoid drowning as they tried to swim more slowly?
It's definitely got that vibe, hasn't it? It's like, so people just being so obsequious when for the flagrant disregard for self-respect. It's funny, but it's also not great, is it?
It's very Middle Eastern, too. Very Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, is that, and that's what I'm wondering. What is actually going on here? Is Trump actually expecting anybody to be impressed by this nonsense, or is it that thing of just basically saying to everybody, if I go down, you're coming with me, you're on camera, you said it.
I don't think he's that clever. I think he just really, really likes praise and has a desperate need to be affirmed and to have approval and to let everyone know he's doing a really good job. You see that when he comes out against the media criticism, and he just seems genuinely aggrieved that anyone could not think and sort of understand what a great job he's doing of it all.
I mean, I think you might be right. I think it's a temptation. Everybody did this, myself included, when he started running and it didn't go down in flames immediately. You start trying to find some subtext there. Is there some cunning plot going on? Is there some meta narrative I'm not alive to? But yeah, I do wonder, Roger, is it just what it looks like?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it says a lot about courtiers, you know, and courts, because this is exactly how our courts were medieval days, you know. But even then, Henry VIII, who would bathe in not in ass's milk but in flattery, would have a joker, no? They would have a jester.
Well, so I was
they'd
just going to say, that's
where's
what this
his jester?
Meaning. There needs to be somebody
who would speak
in one of those weird hats with bells on the ends of the things and curled up shoes and a pig's bladder on a stick.
That's right. And he would say, ha, 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 you look ridiculous. Ha, ha, ha. And nobody's saying that.
You'd get sacked real fast from this cabinet.
Yeah. The May cabinet too, by the way.
Samira, his approval ratings, or rather his disapproval rating, is now at 58%, which is an impressive accomplishment so early in the presidency. Is there anything he can actually do about that at this point?
I don't know. It's... I don't know, maybe more sort of horrible populist moves. I don't know, sort of loads.
Well, there must be a war around somewhere.
That would be demonize a new minority group.
We possibly shouldn't tempt fate. But by way of some corrective, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer welcomed this opportunity to make fun of Trump. He posted the following earlier. It works just as well without the visuals, but I do recommend looking it up.
I want to thank everybody for coming. I just thought we'd go around the room. Lucy, how'd we do on the Sunday show yesterday?
Your tone was perfect. You were right on message.
Michelle, how'd my hair look coming out of the gym this morning?
You have great hair. Nobody has better hair than you.
Before we go any further, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity and blessing to serve your agenda.
It's worth looking. The visuals work because the fade out there is the entire table collapsing into helpless laughter. One can only hope Donald Trump has already seen it. I think we can look forward to Chuck Schumer coming up in a few tweets in the very near future. Samira Shackle and Roger Boys, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House, though neither of you were nearly obsequious enough to the host for my liking. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next at 1900. It's our design show, Section D, and there's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.